Hail to you, loyal listeners. It's another one of Jim Brown's Outrig Capercasts. This is number 22, and it's a straight sea story. I don't suppose any morals or lessons can be taken from it. It's just another example of how goofed up people can get when they go out in the ocean, especially for the first time offshore in the dark when the boogeyman comes out. Last week's issue about racing featured the late Jim McCaig, M-C-C-A-I-G, and in this caper he is again featured as navigator. But the real protagonist is another in our crew, who we call Pops the Pagan Priest. Here we go. It was the mid-1960s. We were living in Santa Cruz, there on the mid-California coast. I was just beginning to make a go of it as a yacht designer. We had little kids growing up, struggling along, but having a great time in what was then a great place. But I was very glad to get a phone call from a man named Tom Ledoux. He was a commander in the Navy at the Naval Air Station in Monterey, not too far from where I lived at Santa Cruz. Somehow Tom had heard good things about cruising trimarans. He had four kids growing up, and he wanted to take them sailing. Now, this was before I even started on the Sea Runner series, so I sold him a set of plans for our 34-footer we called Manta. And Tom began to build the boat at the Navy hobby shop on the airbase. And, well, it wasn't long before he realized he had undertaken an enormous hobby, and he was asking for help. Well, I wanted very much for this boat to exist. It would be a great feather in my cap. So I ended up spending a lot of time down there working with Tom on his boat. And this went on for a couple of years now and then, and about the time the boat was nearing completion, Tom received orders. He was transferred to that great yachting center, Argentia, Newfoundland. And oh man, it was breaking his back, and I was very disappointed. We were about to get the boat in the water, and he didn't know what to do with it. But someone in the Navy hierarchy gave him a recommendation, and they changed his new duty station to Honolulu. So we launched the boat, and they christened her the Tojo Nanpot. I mean, what is it with boat names, anyway? Yes, they're very personal. It turned out that the name of Tom's four kids were Tom, John, Nancy, and Pot. Well, they took the first two letters of the first three kids and put them into Tojo Nan, and then, I don't know, they called the fourth kid Pot, and I don't know why. Was it toilet training? I don't know. Would a parent do such a thing to a kid today? Well, so now we began to prepare for an ocean crossing, the first to be made in any of my boats. I was invited to go along, and I was also asked to help put a crew together. So I recruited Jim McCaig as navigator, and our friend Bob Pietrobono, who was building another boat of my design at Monterey. That gave us a crew of four, so we had some sea trials. Tom was able to schedule 3 weeks' leave. His family and all their stuff were shipped over to Honolulu, where, incidentally, they had been stationed before, so it was like they were going home. We loaded up the boat, and it looked like things were really go, until, at the last moment, Tom said, "Hey, I want to take another guy." Well, we already had a crew of four, and the boat would handle that. It would be really jammed with five. I objected, but Tom insisted. And when it came time to meet our prospective crewmate, which was just a few days before our planned embarkation, he was introduced to us as Father Bob. That's right, he was a young Catholic priest. Well, okay, he seemed to be a nice enough guy, but he had never sailed, never been out in the ocean in his life. Well, I thought something was a little strange about this, but we all got together at Tom's house for a strategy meeting, and Tom's wife, who was a wonderful, supportive woman, was also what you might call an absolute drill sergeant of a gal. and she laid down the law. She said, "One thing you guys got to hear from me is that I don't want any booze on that boat. None. I don't want one drop of alcohol of any kind to go with you on that boat. You hear me? I'm telling you now, no booze." Well, that was okay with me. You know, we hadn't really planned to take any booze anyway. But I later learned that Tom Ledoux, who was, in my view, one of the world's great guys, was a devout Roman Catholic, and he apparently felt that at some point in his life he had been a really bad boy. And when contemplating facing 2,400 miles of open Pacific in a boat that he had built in a hobby shop, it seemed to him like, well, he had a chance of dying in the sea. And if that was to happen, he was going to need some supernatural assistance in order to make it into heaven. There was no alternative. We had a Catholic priest in our crew. And it was kind of nice, you know. I think it made us all feel a little more secure. So off we went. It was July, the very best month for making that passage, and we had nice conditions for the first several days. It was light airs, lollygagging around in a calm sea. We were all doing fine, or so I thought, until the pilot whales showed up. Right, we were intercepted by a squadron of what appeared to be giant porpoises, 20-foot whales. There were maybe 6 or 8 of them. They would approach from astern, pass under the boat, go on out ahead and dive, and then later come up again from astern. It seemed like there must have been an endless supply, but I believe there was only 6 or 8. We got to know them. They became more and more familiar with this. They would slide up alongside one of the floats. We'd be hanging over the side, peering down into their faces, eyeball to eyeball, so to speak. And then they'd hit the throttle and just take off like a shot. And then they began snuggling in underneath the hull and actually whapping the hull with their tails. They would also whap the rudder. If you were on the helm, you could get a good jolt. Then they'd zoom ahead and dive again. Well, Pops began to pray. Tom went down below and got the flare pistol. He was going to shoot him in the nose. The other 3 of us were just laughing, taking pictures, trying to holler at him. But this interception went on long enough to become a bit uncomfortable. Finally, I said, "Okay, they're just toying with us. They think maybe we're a hot number, so let's drop the sails and just stop." We did that, and the whales just circled around, spouting at us. Well, while we were sitting there, the wind came up a little, and it was fair from behind. So I said, "Okay, let's get out the spinnaker." We had made a spinnaker from a parachute at the parachute loft on the Navy base. Stitched it up ourselves. It had some rather hard spots and some rather bosomy spots. But we hoisted that thing up there and the boat began to move. But the whales thought this was wonderful. They continued their explorations of what must have seemed to them this strange triple fish. And now and then they would really bump into the floats. This boat did not have a centerboard. It had fixed fins in the floats to offer a little lateral resistance. And they were pretty big. They went about 4 feet deep. They were just made out of 3/4-inch plywood, heavily fiberglassed. So now we got the mainsail up, and together with the spinnaker, we began to knock out some speed. There were gentle waves behind us, and I'll be darned, the boat commenced to sort of catch a few, and we had some spurts of surfing, something that the boat had not experienced before. And much to my chagrin, the fins in the floats began to vibrate. And now Pops really began to pray, and I tried to convince him that it was not the whales growling at us, it was our own float fins moaning. And his prayers were answered. Almost instantly, the pilot whales disappeared. I can't help but feel that the whales suspected the boat was telling them, "Hey, bugger off. You're being altogether too familiar." However, this encounter had clearly upset Pops. As dinner time approached, he and Tom held a rather formal mass in the cockpit, including communion and lots of chanting of, "Lord, I am not worthy, Lord, I am not worthy." And after dinner, McCaig took me aside and said, "Hey, Brown, altar wine. He's got booze on board." Well, we laughed and didn't think any more about it until the next morning when Pops confessed to us that he was unable to either urinate or defecate. Well, I said, "Just drink some water." But by dinner time that night, it was clear that we had a problem on our hands. Furthermore, the wind had come up. We had apparently gotten into the trades. The waves were building, the boat was boogieing along, and all that Pop could say was, staring at the ocean, "It looks like it's out to get us." And I realized that the poor guy was so terrified that his sphincter muscles could not be relaxed. So as darkness fell and the air got damp, Pops put on his slicker, went out on the side deck, kneeled up against the lifelines, reached over with his hands, held on to his poor pecker and prayed. And I'm sure that the sight of the black water and the white foam streaking past the boat did not serve to relax his sphincters. Pops began begging us to turn back, but there was no going back. It would be against the wind. Take forever. So we gave poor Pops some aspirin, rolled up a towel for him to kneel on, and left him there, tied onto the lifelines as we sailed off into the night. And later on, Pops was praying desperately, imploring the heavens and the sea, and his gracious Lord all came up and joined him and held him and followed his lead in his recitations. But it seemed like there was little else we could do. And McCaig took me aside and said, "Hey, Brown, we got to do something. Get him back in the cockpit. We got to get him to relax." So as we got Pops back into the cockpit, McCaig went down below and started rummaging through his duffel and came up with the altar wine. Now, being an accomplished humorist, McCaig sort of led the way in a little celebration. He said that this was just Pops' initiation to the court of King Neptune, and he started singing some goofy little ditties. Like one he used to sing was, "When the ice is on the rice in Kachatawa, and the sake in the cellar starts to freeze, blah ba dee ba dee ba dee, I can't remember, I'll go home with my little Nipponese." Well, there was some kind of an old barracks ballad that came from his having been stationed in Japan. Just nonsense stuff, and Tom passed around paper cups, said to me quietly, "There's no alcohol in that wine, and it tastes like panther piss." But we all toasted Pop's initiation. Tom was right about the taste. And McCaig led the way in teaching us an old marching song that he had learned in the Air Force. We had to go over it a couple of times. Pops was trying to join in, but McCaig and I had it down. He had taught it to me long before, so we started belting it out. It went something like this. It's a marching song, you know. Left, left, you left, right, left. Are we happy? Are we gay? All through the day, we're the Happy Cats Social Club. Don't be blue, just say true. All the day through, we're the Happy Cats Social Club. Left, right, left. Are we downhearted? No, no, no. So let's get started, and we will show that Happy Cats never flub. Oh, we're the Happy Cats Social Club. And at the end, of course, he would break into harmony. It's the Happy Cats Social Club. And after we all finished applauding ourselves, Pop said, "I wet my pants." And McCaig hollered, "Praise the Lord." And Pop started laughing so hard, he cut a thunderous fart, and then some, had to excuse himself, go down below and clean up. And so it went in the good ship Tojo Nanpot. You know, anyway, we went gliding along in the trades for several days, just having a wonderful time of it. It turned out that Pops was becoming a very good helmsman. But then, all of a sudden, the wind died. And this was not supposed to happen. After all, we had a meteorologist on board. Tom Ledoux was a meteorologist for the Navy. And after we sat for a day and razzed the hell out of him, he finally explained that apparently a so-called trough had moved down out of the Pacific High. And now, the Pacific High is that gyre in the middle of the North Pacific around which the wind rotates. And it has now become the place where all of the flotsam and jetsam from the four corners of the earth have accumulated in a giant junk pile. And we were nowhere near the center of that gyre. But if the conditions in that trough that we experienced were anything like the virginal Pacific High, boy, I'll tell you, to my eye, it was the most beautiful place on the planet. And we had a chance to spend 3 days there in an absolute flat, still calm. It gave us all a chance to rest and get cleaned up the first day. Then the second day, it gave us a chance to try to find something to do with ourselves. You know, we went swimming and fishing. We dropped the anchor down about 40 feet, then jumped over the side. You could go down to the anchor and sit there and look around for as long as you could hold your breath. Looking up, you could see the guys swimming around the boat, but otherwise, it seemed like the boat was sitting in nothing but air. The water was gin clear. And we noticed that the boat had attracted some fish. And before it was all over, we had caught about a 20-pound yellowfin tuna. And we stuffed ourselves, but couldn't eat it all. And because of no refrigeration or even an ice box, you know, we had to throw too much of it away. And that night, we began to really get into staring at the sky. It was incredible out there. No ambient light, clear air. One could really sense that we were sitting on an insignificant little planet whirling around a rather minor sun that was one of 2 billion stars in the Milky Way. We could actually feel ourselves located on like the spoke of a bicycle wheel, and the wheel itself was just an enormous halo of which we were such a minuscule part. And this was at a time when one of the first spacecraft was orbiting the Earth, and we could see that baby zooming through the sky every 90 minutes. And while at first it just looked like another star, if you looked through the binoculars, you could see that it was so close you could practically reach up and touch it. And everything else in the galaxy was unfathomably far away. Clearly, some of the brighter stars were much farther away than some of the dimmer stars. We could see the universe in three dimensions. And when the sun came up in the morning, it was really disappointing because now we were in the period of void. Daylight was isolating. At night, we could see out into the universe. And I was in the cockpit that morning with everyone else in their bunks. And as the atmosphere just began to glow with the very slightest skylight, I marveled at the calm. The sea was so flat, what they call in the Bahamas a slick cam. And someone down below rolled over in his bunk, and just that much motion caused a ring of ripples to move out from the boat. It was that calm in mid-Pacific. But going into the third night, some of the fellows were beginning to get pretty antsy. The boat was equipped with an outboard motor, but we didn't have enough fuel to do much with. We decided to save it for entering the harbor once we got to Hawaii. And now there was talk of the so-called horse latitudes, the doldrums, where the square-rigged ships used to sit sometimes for weeks and they'd run out of water, had to throw their horses overboard. Well, we were nowhere near the doldrums. But both Tom and Pops were getting pretty anxious, and they started to pray, and there were disagreements about whether or not to use the fuel now. There was deep mumbo-jumbo muttering in the cockpit all night long. But sometime before daylight, I began to sense just the slightest swell, an easy undulation from the east. And during breakfast, we noticed just the slightest cat's paws, the faintest riffles of zephyrs bouncing off the crests of the swell. And pretty soon these riffles moved down into the valleys between the crests, and we could feel a breeze. We got the sails up, and by afternoon we were surf riding in the trades. In a way, I was disappointed to leave the steady state of life in the Pacific High. If you could get used to it, I'm sure you could live there indefinitely with enough water and food, and it would be a pretty dreamy existence. I think you'd spend all your daylight hours asleep and do your living at night. It would not be dark. But now we were really going somewhere, man. The boat surging ahead in grand spurts of speed, with just enough sail up to allow the boat to sail at about the same speed as the seaway, something in the mid-teens, with now and then a crest developing right beneath the boat, lifting us up and then hurling us off toward Honolulu. And steering in this stuff required concentration, no autopilot, and Pops would plug himself into that helm and stay there for hours, taking one other crewman's watch after another. He got very good at it, and he just loved it. But McCaig was our real touchstone. He tried to teach us all how to do celestial navigation. At night it was identifying the stars. You see that little cluster of stars up there with the bright one in the middle, right up there? The bright one in that little clump of dim ones, that's Betelgeuse. She's easy to identify because she looks just like a diamond in a goat's ass. At this latitude and at this time of year, you want to shoot the sun about 45 minutes before noon. And then you got to catch it right at noon, and then you got to shoot it again maybe 45 minutes after noon. And then we're going to work out all three sights, and the lines of position we get off of those three sights are going to give us a nice triangle on the chart. We call that a three-star fix on the sun at noon. And that was a lot easier than trying to identify three stars at night and trying to get a nice tight triangle on the chart. And well, after about 2 weeks of these shenanigans, McCaig pronounced that we were coming right in on the beam. He said, the way we're going, tomorrow morning after breakfast, we're going to sight the volcanoes on Oahu. And he was spot on, man. And those peaks were a glorious sight, but it took us all day to get there. And I think none of us was very pleased to see the voyage end. We talked of what a shame it was to spend 15 days just getting used to it, and now we could just go on forever. But we all had lives ashore, of course, and it was time for us to tie up and fly home. And looking down on the ocean from the airplane, of course, it was not quite believable that we had covered all that distance among all those millions of trade wind waves down there, and all on the power of the wind alone. Okay, so that was a truly beautiful passage, and with the possible exception of our encounter with the pilot whales, and Pops's rather frightening distress, and the rather spooky feeling of sitting in mid-ocean with no wind, we hadn't had any trouble with the boat, and nothing really went wrong. No one even got seasick. Pops's problem was not nausea, it was fear, and while fear is often associated with nausea, we all came through unscathed. But it ain't always so. Going to sea, especially for the first time, requires significant psychological and physiological adjustments. It is particularly disorienting to the eyes and ears. There's such a vast gulf between looking at the boat and looking at the horizon that it seems to me you practically have to learn how to see all over again. And of course the inner ear, when its kinesthetic sense is subjected to waves of a certain frequency, it seems it's not so much their size, it's their period, the length of time from crest to crest, that really upsets people's whole system, especially the stomach. So I would be remiss without mentioning another passage to Honolulu that was made in a sister ship to the Tojo Nanpot. The same Manta design, built by a couple of fine guys near San Francisco. And again, what is it with boat names? They painted their vessel blue and named it the Yellow Submarine. And they took their girlfriends off to Hawaii without any of them having ever been to sea before. They all had some difficulty. One of the guys came home with the impression that the sea was always out to get them. He could not accept Gordon Bach's great lyric, "It don't know nor even care you're there." And gracious, one of the women was obliged to take to her bunk the first hour out and stayed there for the next 17 days, unable to hold anything down. Upon arrival, she had to be evacuated from the boat by ambulance. So the lesson of this caper is, my gosh, give yourself a chance to get used to the ocean gradually. Launch your boat and take on the sea trials on nice days. Don't go out when it's blowy right away. And do some local coastal cruising. Enjoy the anchorages, the overnights, the days of simply sitting on the boat and going nowhere. And when you're ready to really jump off, try loading up and heading out to the nearest anchorage. Drop the hook if you can still see home, and hang out for an overnight before shoving off into the big blue briny. And if you're going to use seasick pills, practice with two or three before making a big deal voyage. The response to those drugs can be quite individual. And try to find the one that works for you. For starters, I suggest bonine, not monamine, bonine. It's an old drug. There's a huge history with it. It's prescribed mainly for treating dizziness in older people. Start the drug a day or even 2 days ahead of time. Start on a half dose. Get used to it. Live with it. Get your system used to it. And above all, eat. Keep your stomach busy with heavy, wholesome food. And if you start feeling queasy, there's nothing better than turning off the autopilot and taking the helm. Keep your eyes upon the compass and the horizon. Of course, there are people who need no introduction, but generally speaking, give yourself a chance to accommodate the extraterrestrial world. Of course, not everyone takes to it, but if you do, you'll soon find that it's way too rich, way too fun, and way too real not to be doing it. Okay, so Christy's tearing her hair. We're kicking 30 minutes in the butt again. So I'm asking you, please let me know what you think of these longer caper casts. It's by request. And hey, here's a hearty hail to Ken Borgers and Tom Ruff for their singular participation in this project. Because of them, I now have an operations budget, an actual budget. I thank you. We should all thank you, because with your help, I'm going to keep these capers coming for a while. Okay, farewell. Till next time, we speak a passing ship. Bye-bye.